Yeah, final talk, please, sorry. And this is Michael Kurtzmeier from here, from Maynooth, and he's going to talk about preservation, reconstruction of usage of web community data.
Hello, good morning, and thank you all for having me, first of all. So this is a talk about archiving community web data. And as a starting point, I'm going to talk about a Usenet forum archive. Now, for the purpose of this talk, what we need to know is that Usenet is a text-based internet service. It works kind of like a forum, and it's one of the earliest internet services. If you go forward, you see that Avery Dame of Maryland University did an amazing work turning parts of Usenet into an archive. You can see it here, it's called the Transgender Usenet Archive. And I'd like to invite all of you to have a good look at this project, because I think it's a great resource. Wait till I'm done talking. Yeah? And so just to give you a brief overview of what you can do with this Usenet archive. So of course you can do some data analytics on it, and you can see all those individual posts, all those little notes you see, and you can see how they refer to each other. And he uses that to track back the first usage of the expression cisgender, and it tries to track it back to early discussions amongst that. And of course, you can also just browse around, just browse the discussions, get a feeling for what was being debated in the community at the time. So when I started working on this talk, I did so with two assumptions, I have to tell you. And the first is that the times were simpler, that social groups just had one or a few websites where they would organize, and they would not have dozens of profiles, dozens of hashtags, they wouldn't have hidden groups. And also that hard and software was also simpler, it was way easier to understand, and it would be way easier to archive. Now, I was very quickly proven wrong. This is also from a presentation that Avery gave on his project. And of course you can see there was magazines, there was conferences, there was get-togethers, there was papers, there was like dozens of other places you could probably see there was like meetups, bars, whatever, where organization would have happened. So for the first part of the talk, I'd just like to talk about how I got to this wrong impression and maybe what we can learn from this. So to start off with the first assumption, namely that times were simpler and that organization did not happen with the fluidity that we see today. Now, I'm not an archaeologist, and because I'm not, I can afford to make this really crude analogy that came to my mind. So imagine you find the remains of an old settlement, and all you see is stones. Would you assume that A, the houses were built from stone and stone only, B, that all houses in this period were built from stone and stone only, and maybe even see that the people that lived there slept in stone beds and ate from stone plates? Well, this is pretty much what I did. But after I thought that through, I realized that there's a fallacy of reconstruction, if you want to call it that. I was so focused on what I saw, namely the archive forums, that I attempted to reconstruct the whole scene or the whole social group through that one resource that I had available. While in reality, just as with that settlement, some things, for just a number of reasons, are way better preserved than others. And in most cases, it is exactly what you cannot see that tells you most about a place. And my second assumption was that hard and software of the time was just so much simpler, easier to understand, and easier to archive. This is partially true, but my approach to it was wrong. My approach implied that people of the early web for some reason randomly choose to have those low-spec machines and those text-based internet services. And this is only true, I think, if you want to explain the whole world out of your own perspective and the whole internet out of your current laptop. The reality is that while, of course, hardware and software was very different from what we're used to seeing now, it was the standard of the time and place as much as our machines are pretty much the standard of our time, the standard of our place today. Every time you design a piece of software, of course, it's going to be a trade-off between hardware requirements and performance or features. If internet is dial-up and uses pay per minute, do you think that a video streaming service would be a good idea? Probably not. On the other hand, a text-based forum works really well under those conditions because you can download the whole forum, close the connection, and then take your time and read through it and dial up again the next day. So what we're looking at technically when we look back at internet services is not unqualified attempts to emulate all the shiny things that we're used to today, but we're looking at probably the best possible service in an environment that was described by resource scarcity. And earlier I mentioned standard of time and place, and so far I talked about time as if all progress was the same everywhere. But if we look at communities that are more affected by scarcity than others, and I think we had some great examples here earlier, we see that the way those communities engage with their resources, engage with the internet, varies widely. So from the way people would engage with the internet in Dublin versus they would do so in Rhode Island, there would be huge differences. But so we wouldn't see a naturally evolved way of how people use the internet. So whatever we describe as usage habits of the internet and of digital content in general is not a natural consequence of technological progress. Neither is the same at the same time. It's defined by economic conditions. So what can we learn from this? So to go back to my initial assumptions, when we see archived content, we cannot assume that what we see is all there what was. This would mean to underestimate the complexity of the past. Instead, we have to assume high loss rates even among archival content. Physical artifacts are much easier to collect. And I use collect here, not preserve or archive, because those things are very different. So, also we cannot have a deterministic view on the complexity of systems. The web now is very different from what it was in 1990, and many of our everyday devices would have passed as near supercomputers a decade or two ago. The web saw a massive change in scope. You can see behind me David Wiseman of Toronto University, who helped archive parts of the Usenet by pretty much picking up those storage tapes. You can see here, they held most of the Usenet, and loading them onto his truck and driving them back to Toronto, and where one day they would, with the help of the Internet Archive, become part of this collection. Now, imagine you would do something like this just for, say, the water charges movement. Imagine what the physical data this movement has accumulated would look like. You'd have to have a pretty big truck to load them all up, I suppose. So what we really see there is a change in the way that people engage with digital content. And the internet has undergone a fundamental and is still ongoing in reorganization. So this is what I will talk about in the second part. And the second part, I'd like to start with a simple question. If someone asked you, what is the best way to describe myself or to present myself on the internet? What would you say? I mean, maybe you'd say something like this, but it depends on your angle. There's LinkedIn, there's you can have a blog, there's Twitter, you know, if you want to have an academic profile, if you want to have a professional profile. Now, imagine what your answer might have been 10 or 15 years ago. 15 years ago, I would have probably recommended making your own website, even though today that seems a bit odd in most cases. So this brings us to a bit of the evolution of content. So what we're looking here is a sample post on Usenet. And what we need to understand, just for the purpose of this talk again, this is very much shaped like an email. This is pretty much an email that is sent to a general server that is distributed to everyone who's also subscribed to those groups. Right? You'd have a message ID, a reference ID, a news group that it was supposed to go to. And what I'm trying to say is that within this time period, the internet saw a change from lots of human-made HTML and CSS content as here towards more machine-made dynamic sites. The early web I would describe as pretty much a what you see is what you get attitude, as in what kind of HTML code you put in is what the page will look like. And what you see is what you get has largely been replaced by what's called content management systems, where you drag and drop, and it looks very different for every user. It could look different on a phone, it could look different on a tablet. And as maybe another example, I'd like you to look at this really, I call it artisan, self-contained homepage of a library at my old university back in Germany. And if you want to look at the code, go ahead, you'll see it doesn't even employ a CSS file. But I think what is most important for us, if we look at kind of this content analysis that we have here, you see this whole page has two images. It is all first-party content. And this is not something I archive. This is something, if you go to this URL there, bbb-unitubingen, it's still up to date. If we compare this to my news university library page, you see that it is not only much more complex, but it is also responsive. So pretty much if you go to this site on your phone, it will look different than if you do that on your laptop. And just to have a very quick look at all the red here, so all the red is second or third party content that the website is trying to load from like Facebook for a plugin, from Cloudflare for performance, or it's trying to connect, of course, to the API to do a search on the library catalog. And if you ask yourselves why that is, did the average user just get sick of HTML and decide it was time to move on? What I suggest is this change was part of a stronger centralization effort. Many early websites, and I'm talking about the really large ones now, were focused on one or two main topics. For example, you'd have one page for sharing photos, another one for chatting to friends, and another one for discussing whatever niche interests. Nowadays, we're more seeing huge platforms that attempt to cater to as many aspects of digital life as possible. Just think of giants like Google and all the services they offer, or rather try to think of a service they don't offer. Together with that also came a huge change in roles, as is exemplified here. While on the early web, roles such as user or creator were only loosely defined and your options were pretty much limited by your ability, we're now seeing more rigidly defined roles and possibilities. And with a change towards centralization come two implications for web archiving. Now, I'm finally going back to web archiving there. Firstly, content is usually easier to find but harder to reach. That means that information relies on back-end services such as databases, and they're usually within the platform's infrastructure, they're only accessible through an individual query. Secondly, the window of opportunity for web archiving shrinks. Most of those internet giants operate for profit, meaning for attention and user data, as you said, to get people to click the link. And that's an inherent conflict between preservation of non-mainstream content and competition for clicks. We just heard that Google announced the end of its social network, Google+. Going back to the question earlier, how many of the services that you may have recommended for presenting yourself on the internet 10 years ago are still around? Or how many of the they would have recommended now would you think might still be around in 10 years? And for a final part, I just want to look at what we can do to preserve material in the wake of this. I want to start this last section with the introduction of insider and outsider perspectives. Insider perspective for me means the person involved in a group or a social movement. An outsider perspective describes a journalist or an academic researcher. I think all academic perspectives should contain elements of an outsider's view on the topic. Both of those, though, have their own motivations, they have their own advantages and their own drawbacks. But both also face the same problems, but they have different tools at hand. So what can we do? I think the first step is to understand, not to understand that I'm right in everything I said, but to understand that the way the web works is fundamentally different to how it did 20 years ago. That a change in the ways content is created and distributed brings new challenges to archiving it. That if you're part of a project, you can fall to the digital wayside very quickly if whatever platform you are depending on decides to kick you out for whatever reason. Both insiders and outsiders will have to account for this. The second step is to act. It means to understand structural efforts and how and if things will be available in the future. This means for the insider to maybe use alternative services that offer more control over user data, are far less vulnerable to corporate interests and government influence. It can mean for the outsider to understand that hardware challenges will rise as your archival efforts get closer to the present. But it means for both to act, to archive. Everything you have, whatever shape or form, is better than what you don't have. If you don't, there might be no one left to tell your story one day. Or maybe even worse, your story will be falsified. And I like to end this talk with a note for both the in and the outsiders. I know what I described here sounds bleak. I think it's important to acknowledge reality and to act on it. But you should never be discouraged. If you give people a voice, please continue doing so. Thank you.